We had the opportunity to go to Nicaragua for 10 days, and that was just prior to the flooding they had down in Nicaragua. So it was a very meaningful experience to me, and I feel it my duty to pass on the information that I received when I was down there. And also, it's really generated an ongoing interest in me. I kind of studied it in the course this year at school, kind of an independent study, but unfortunately I don't have my notes with me from that, so I'll just try to wing it. I'd like to start out by emphasizing that the revolution that happened in Nicaragua in 1979 was a Christian revolution. Many Christians were involved. The country is extremely Catholic and has a lot of Protestant influence in the north now. But it was a very Christian revolution. In fact, many priests are participating in the government right now. So I'd like to start out with the Bible passage that pertains to the situation, I believe. And Jesus came to Nazareth. Oh, this is Luke 4, verses 16 through 21. And Jesus came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and he went to the synagogue, as his custom was on the Sabbath day. And he stood up to read, and there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." And he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed upon him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." This passage pertains to the situation in Nicaragua because a lot of Nicaraguans, especially those who are avid Christians, believe that the acceptable year of the Lord was in some ways fulfilled through the Nicaraguan Revolution. And so I'd like to tell you a little bit more about it. First of all, I think that we as North Americans, it's our duty to know the role of our government, in the United States government, in Central America throughout the last century. So I'd like to start by, start in 1823. The Monroe Doctrine proclaimed the Latin American countries were protected by the United States, and they would remain that way because they were our interests. It was like our satellite countries. So that was part of our manifest destiny. Also, then the Guantanamo Bay military base is established in Cuba, which is ironically still there, and that's a base where a lot of the naval activities have sprouted from concerning Central America even now. In 1904, the Roosevelt Corollary is made to the Monroe Doctrine, and it said that the United States has right to exercise international police power to correct chronic wrongdoing or impotence in the Western Hemisphere. So we extend our influence once again through that corollary. After World War II, Truman stated that we could exert police power to anywhere in the world threatened by communism. So, once again, we're proclaiming our interests throughout the world in maintaining the whole world as our own satellite. In 1961, the Bay of Pigs was brought about. That operation was brought about after Cuba had been taken over by Fidel Castro, and that was mounted from Nicaragua, where the United States had many army bases. The Alliance for Progress was a move which many Americans applauded because they thought we were finally doing something good for the poverty-stricken of Latin America. But essentially, it was just a program in order to attract foreign investment to these countries and also to train Latin American armies in counterinsurgency warfare. So it wasn't the altruistic thing that we all thought it was. In 1979, that was a rather volatile year in Central America. That was the year when the Shah of Iran fell, but also Grenada, which is a small country, it would be right down here on the map, that had a popular revolution. And so now there are three socialist countries in Latin America: Cuba, Nicaragua, and Grenada. No one hears about Grenada because it's so insignificant. Jamaica also underwent a large popular insurrection. El Salvador and Guatemala also started to really get their popular support up then as well. The reason this came about is from a worldwide economic crisis. This is the rising oil prices really having an effect. And also, in addition to this, the falling coffee and sugar prices upon which the economies of these countries are very much dependent upon. Carter, during this time, he was very concerned about Nicaragua because the revolution, it seemed, was verging on inevitably falling to the Sandinistas, who had the popular support of the people. So Carter did some last-ditch efforts to prevent the Sandinistas from gaining power because he sought a more moderate government that would come in after the Somozas. So he gave aid to Somoza in the final couple months. He gave aid to Somoza after Somoza promised to improve on his human rights conditions. He was notorious for having some of the worst. So he was kind of the El Salvador of 1979. And so Carter gave him aid just on his promise to improve the conditions in the future. So that was kind of bogus. But then later, Carter sought normal diplomatic relations because he realized that it was important that the Sandinistas were going to rule Nicaragua, and it was important to maintain diplomatic relations so that they wouldn't become so alienated from the United States, and so he could foster more of a moderate influence in Nicaragua. So he arranged an economic aid package in which some of the money, like $23 million, made it to Nicaragua, but the rest was cut off when Reagan took office. He said, you know, forget it. The 1980 Republican Convention, in its platform, was committed to overthrowing the Marxist Nicaragua. And now we hear so much about Reagan's Caribbean Basin Initiative, but that disregards Nicaragua altogether because he really wants to have nothing to do with it except for undermining it. Now I'd like to get into the history of Nicaragua. By the way, up on this chart here, it has the various dates that the United States had invaded Nicaragua. So you can see the big influence that we had there, especially in the early 1900s. 1909, a man by the name of Zayala, who was a nationalist, was the president of Nicaragua. And I don't know if any of you remember this from history, but before the Panama Canal was established, Nicaragua was really seen as a very good possibility for a transoceanic canal because of the numerous lakes that are in Nicaragua, so they wouldn't have to do so much digging. So that was very appealing to the United States government. But this Zayala wasn't willing to just hand over these rights to the American government. He said, no, you're going to have to pay for them. And also, your industries, we're going to have a little bit better agreements on that. In other words, he didn't want to have a favorable trade climate and investment climate for the entrepreneurs who wanted to come into Nicaragua. So in 1912, the United States said, hold it, you know, we don't like to be pushed around by these small Latin American nations. So the Marines were sent in, and they kept control of the country pretty much until 1933. They kept the Conservative Party in control through pretty much a military occupation. And in 1925, as you can see, there's a split there. In 1925, they tried to get out, but there was a popular uprising by a man by the name of Augusto Cesar Sandino, the namesake for the present regime. And that was a people's movement that was rising up against the American overlords that were in Nicaragua at that time. So the Marines had to go back in and quell that uprising, and so they were there until 1933. In 1933, they said, well, you know, we've been mingling in their affairs a little bit too much, maybe. We're getting some bad press back home. So they established a National Guard, and the leader of that was a man by the name of Anastasio Somoza I. And he had been educated in Philadelphia. In fact, there are a lot of stories that he used to be a used car salesman in Philadelphia, which says something about his credibility, I guess. And and he really endeared himself to the Marines who were in occupation in Nicaragua at this time. So they made him the head of the National Guard. And so as things went, in 1933, when the National Guard left, he proclaimed himself president. And his family ruled, you know, it was passed on to the eldest son. His family ruled until 1979, when the revolution stopped their power. One thing about Somoza is he was very friendly to the United States throughout. All the Somozas were very friendly with the United States throughout their reigns. FDR said, Somoza might be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. So that kind of says where the United States stood in the whole thing. Everyone knew, you know, how bad these people were, but we continued to support them because they were in our economic interests. The Somoza family holdings, they held one half of the arable land and 40% of the industry of Nicaragua, which shows their power economically and politically. And that doesn't say anything about the honchos that they had, their underlings, you know, who were with them in the National Guard. They, you know, they held a good percentage of the rest of it. I believe that there were two major events in Nicaragua that led to the overthrow of the Somoza regime. One was the 1972 earthquake. I don't know if any of you remember the Christmas earthquake, but I remember it was big news to me.
Wasn't that when Roberto Clemente died? That's what I remember.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he was flying down on an aid mission. Well, what happened then, the scary thing is if Somoza had handled that right, there probably isn't much doubt that he would still be in power. But anyway, what happened is the aid package that we sent down, the food, clothing, things like that, Somoza's cronies sold to the Nicaraguans. And this is Managua was a town that lost 20 to 30,000 people in the earthquake, and one half of the 400,000 population of that city was homeless after the earthquake. And here he is selling the food and the clothing that had been given to him to the people, and then putting that money into his coffers. And also the financial assistance that came in, he put directly into his coffers. Because, you know, I guess he figured what's good for Somoza is good for Nicaragua. You know, we've heard that all the time. So anyway, that alienated him very much, even with the other elites within Nicaragua who were doing pretty well economically. They said, you know, hold it, you know, your greed's just getting a little bit too much here. So I think he lost a lot of influence there. And also, the Sandinistas were really having very much support in their uprising. And in 1977, a man by the name of Pedro Joaquin Chamorro, who was the editor of La Prensa, which was the major newspaper in Nicaragua at that time, he was assassinated in cold blood. And everyone, you know, knew who it was. It was the rightists in Nicaragua who were supporting Somoza. And a lot of people have different feelings about what he was doing. A lot of people feel he was very self-interested. But anyway, Chamorro was a man who spoke out against Somoza in the final days and the days leading up to that. So he has become a martyr of the revolution. This is the name of the newspaper before La Prensa. And now there are three newspapers, La Prensa, Nuevo Diario, and Barricada. La Prensa now, ironically, is the opposition newspaper. It's the one that everyone believes the CIA is using subliminal journalism in, and they've infiltrated their ranks. And that is one of Chamorro's sons is the editor of La Prensa, and that currently has the highest circulation in Nicaragua. So, you know, take what you may from that. Nuevo Diario is more of a moderate paper, but it's tending towards the Sandinistas. It's a paper run by Chamorro's brother. So it's the uncle of the editor of La Prensa is the editor of Nuevo Diario, and most of the people involved in this newspaper are the people who used to be involved in La Prensa when it was before the revolution. And Barricada is the voice of the FSLN, the Sandinista Liberation Front. And that's, you know, a lot of people think it's a very biased paper, but, you know, they are supporting their cause, and that is, Barricada is very much, they tell the truth a lot more than La Prensa. Anyway, I'll get into that a little later. Another thing that about Nicaragua before the revolution, it was Somoza had made it a member of CONDECA, which is the Council of Central American Defense. This is where all the Central American countries have gotten together and they're cooperating with the United States Department of Defense in order to, you know, if one falls, then they all rise to the support. It hasn't really had much impact lately, but it is there, the entity is there. Before the overthrow, Nicaragua was the Latin American country with the most soldiers, the most officers, the most police officers trained directly by the United States. So we definitely had a big influence there, both economically and militarily and politically. So that shows the power of the FSLN to overthrow this. The conditions when the revolution was won. Let's see, the date's over there. What is it? July 19th, 1979. The conditions in the country, there was 70% illiteracy. In the rural areas, it was over 86%. 16.1% of the population had potable water, and 102 per 1,000 live births were deaths. So that was their infant mortality rate. I'm going to go down this list of people here, and because I think that will help describe the situation during the revolution and after the revolution. Augusto Cesar Sandino was a revolutionary between 1925 and 1934. In 1934, Somoza said, okay, I'm ready to negotiate with you, and we'll have some peace talks. He called him into Managua, and he was assassinated on site. The FSLN is the Sandinista Liberation Front. It was founded by Carlos Fonseca and Eduardo Contreras. The Mosquito Indians are what you hear a lot about in the news. They're concentrated in the eastern border, which is a very not very densely populated area of Nicaragua. This is where Managua is. Right on the western seaside is where most of the population is. I'll talk about the mosquitoes later. The Literacy Campaign was a campaign that sent out 100,000 youths after the War of Liberation in order to bring down the illiteracy rate. And they did bring it down from, illiteracy rates, you don't know what to believe, but it's believed now that they have it down to 12% illiteracy from well over 50%. The Archbishop Obando y Bravo, he was initially very much in favor of the revolution, because he saw what a bad government Somoza had, but now he's in opposition to the Sandinistas. So he's somewhere in between. He doesn't like the Marxist part of the Sandinistas now, especially because of their popular church idea. They don't like the hierarchy so much. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. Miguel de Escoto is a priest. He's presently the foreign minister of Nicaragua. Ernesto Cardenal is the minister of culture. He's a priest as well. His brother Fernando is a priest. He was the head of the literacy campaign. Anthony Quainton is the new Nicaraguan ambassador from the United States. John Negroponte is the United States ambassador to the Honduras, where a lot of the counter forces are being trained and operated from. Orlando Tardencias, do any of you remember when the United States advisors in El Salvador had picked up this person who they knew was a Nicaraguan fighting for El Salvador, and they carted him up to the United States in handcuffs and everything, and paraded him before the press? Well, that's that guy, and we had a chance to see him while we were in Nicaragua. Luisa Amanda Espinosa is the major woman involved in the revolution. The revolution prides itself upon being not a sexist revolution. You know, the women had a very big role in it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. It's gonna be a long night. Daniel Ortega is presently one of the junta who's ruling the country. Stedman Faggot, the way they pronounce it down there, was a Protestant missionary who was very, very influential among the Mosquito Indians here, and kind of led them against the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas is the popular movement that won the revolution. The Somocistas are the folks who were followers of Somoza. So I'll be using that term. The Rio Coco is the river between Nicaragua and the Honduras, where a lot of the fighting is going on now. These are the three newspapers, as I spoke of earlier. Genesis 2 is a women's organization concerned with promoting breastfeeding, daycare, just a lot of the basic health needs of women in Latin America that have been neglected for so long. And Eden Pastora was one of the heroes of the revolution, but then he turned against the revolution. And there are many stories about that as far as why he did it, but it seems to be personal reasons and personal vendettas that he had against other personalities of the revolution. Here, I've written down here a lot of the articles in various periodicals that I've found interesting, and I think Sojourners does the best job of explaining, especially in their most recent issue of March 1983. Christian Century is one that Tom brought to my attention, and that is a Reaganite goes to Nicaragua and his impressions. So it's really interesting. Very well done. And down at the bottom are some books that I would recommend. Okay. First of all, I want to say that the Nicaraguan Revolution was a revolution of popular support. It still has a popular support in Nicaragua, from all that I could see. It had a lot to do with the grassroots of the Catholic Church coming together and seeing that it was their duty as Christians to do something about their oppression. And this was done out of after Vatican II and Medellin and the Medellin Conference, which spoke more of the Catholic Church as being a church of the people, which gave the people more power and more dignity. They didn't have to be subservient to the hierarchy of the church. Once again, I'd like to say the women were very involved, although now I'd like to... This is something that Genesis 2 said. They said that they were very... You know, it's great that the women were involved in the struggle, in the armed struggle of the revolution, but now they're being neglected. There are no women in the directorate or in the junta, very few in the Council of State, which are the three governing bodies now. And they feel that women, you know, sure, you did your job in the revolution, but now go back to the old traditional roles. And a lot of women are very upset by that. And they don't feel that the Sandinista revolution, or that the revolution has carried through on their promises that way. And I had this pretty much the same feeling when I was down there, just from my small observation. Okay. The War of Revolution, the victory was July 19th, 1979. 50,000 died in the revolution. And just before Somoza was overthrown completely, he left the country and he robbed all of the national coffers. So he left Nicaragua with a $1.5 billion debt and with only $3 million in their bank. So if any of you know anything about international politics and economics, if a country has a debt like that and undergoes a change of government, that new government has to prove its credibility by respecting the old debts, or else no one will give debts or will give loans to people who haven't paid on old debts. So here they are, they're stuck with those debts and they have to respect those. So, you know, that put them in a bind from the start. Another problem that Nicaragua had right after the revolution and is still having is that it's a young government, people who haven't had any experience. These are revolutionaries who haven't had any governing experience as such, and they'll be the first to admit it. They admit their mistakes very readily, but they do make a lot. And a lot of people, including themselves, feel that a lot of their handling of the Mosquito Indians was very poorly managed. I'd like to talk about some of the accomplishments by the Sandinistas since the revolution took place. Polio has been eradicated. There's been a lower infant mortality rate. There have been many commendations to them on their prison conditions. I think since the revolution, when we were down there, 3,000 ex-National Guardsmen had been rehabilitated through their prison system, and they felt that, you know, probably 90% of them had fled up to the Honduras in order to fight against the Sandinistas. So the rehabilitation didn't do anything, but they also weren't vengeful and didn't kill these people. As I said, the literacy campaign lowered the illiteracy rate to 12%. The government is very self-critical. They're presently providing for the people's basic needs, and a lot of the middle classes a lot of people in the middle class are very unhappy with the conditions because they aren't getting the luxury goods that they used to get, because they have to cut down on that in order for their balance of trade to be more favorable towards them. They successfully renegotiated their loans. Public health was improved. There are many more doctors are available to everyone now, and not just the elite. People have pride and dignity restored in themselves. They're not the oxen of Somoza anymore. And the government says, sure, we have a clear bias, but we benefit the poor majority. 12,000 landless were given land, and there's more promise in the future, but that's a slow process. And there's been a 15 to 25% increase in staple food production in Nicaragua since the revolution. And just in general, while I was down there, it was just amazing that people felt like they had some control over their futures. Whereas under Somoza, everything seemed futile. So there was a real energy that I experienced in Nicaragua. But one wonders how long that energy can last when so many external forces are coming down upon them, as well as internal problems and a lot of the problems I've named. Some of the other obstacles, first of all, there's the large debt, little or no aid from the United States. And the United States is a natural trading partner for Nicaragua. And when a natural trading partner the size of the United States doesn't do trade with you, then your economy, has to just be devastated by that. And so they're really, really feeling, pretty bad about that, because there's no one to trade with. Currently, worldwide coffee prices are very low. The CIA Reagan has put $19 million to the CIA for covert activities in Nicaragua. And that's been all over the newspapers. He doesn't hide that at all. So you wonder how much is actually being put in there. Another problem is that doctors and other professional people are flocking out of the country because they just frankly can't make the same money that they can make in other countries in Nicaragua because, there's a ceiling on that. So yeah, that's a big problem. And also the counter-revolutionaries. A lot of them are coming down from the Honduras, and also within Nicaragua itself, there are many counter-revolutionaries because not everyone's going to be happy with such a revolution. And so they've had to divert a lot of their money from economic and social programs to military and defense. And a lot of people say, well, they're just going to be a military power, a Marxist military power, but I mean, it's reality. They have to defend themselves. Another thing is when Alexander Haig and Thomas Enders were in office, they were just throwing the rhetoric left and right, picking on Nicaragua and just slaying some slanderous statements, and no one would refute those. So that hurt Nicaragua quite a bit. And Gene Kirkpatrick, the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, is constantly flapping her mouth about the Marxist regime in Nicaragua, which doesn't do Sandinista cause any good either. However, with George Shultz, there hasn't been so much rhetoric against the Sandinistas, but I think there's been a lot more covert action because he's just as much of a red baiter and an anti-communist force in the Reagan government. The Honduran border, since 1980, 375 Nicaraguans have been killed. And the floods in May of 1982, just after I was there, also had a big impact upon the economy, because it just seems like one thing hits them after another, so they can't get their feet back on the ground. And also a lot of the more fundamentalist Protestant missionaries down there are calling things like that the wrath of God coming down upon the Sandinistas. And a lot of the people believe that sort of talk, so that doesn't help their cause very much. As far as the Cuban and Soviet influence is concerned, there are 2,000, right after the revolution, there were 2,000 Cuban doctors and teachers who came to Nicaragua. And a lot of people really said, raised their eyebrows and said, wow, one Marxist helps another, and we're in for bad trouble in Nicaragua. But frankly, Nicaragua doesn't want to receive aid from Cuba or the Soviet Union because they feel that there are a lot of ties that are made there that they don't want to have to deal with. But that's the only place where they're getting their aid and their help. So, when you ask one person, they turn you down, then you go to the next person. That's exactly what they're doing. And the Cubans seem to be responding. They insist that they're not trying to export the revolution to El Salvador. They feel that El Salvador has the popular support as it is, and They deny that they're sending any arms to El Salvador, as Ronald Reagan feels that they are. Are there any questions at this point?
I thought I read somewhere that Nicaragua offered the United States a joint sort of patrol of their border to make sure that no arms crossed over into El Salvador.
Right.
The United States refused. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And without explanation, they refused. So, you know, what are you going to say? And also, Mexico has really been trying to push negotiations between Nicaragua and the United States. The old president, I think it's carried over to the new president of Mexico, is really trying to push that, and the United States says no deal. You know, they'd rather stick with their covert activities. And they've had a lot of military maneuvers up in the Honduras and off the Atlantic coast just to intimidate the Nicaraguans. So it seems dismal, but there is still hope. As far as the United States is concerned, what we have at stake, Ronald Reagan believes in the domino theory. You know, if one nation falls, then the next one will go. And he sees that happening. You know, first Nicaragua went, then El Salvador will go, and then Guatemala, and eventually the Honduras, and even Costa Rica will fall. So that's where Reagan's coming from. But his concern isn't so much with Nicaragua itself, but that domino theory. And he's afraid that that's going to extend all the way down into Panama, because half of the United States imported goods go through the Panama Canal. And 2/3 of the oil goes through the Panama Canal that we receive. Not through the Panama Canal, but through the Panama Canal or the Gulf of Mexico. And both of those, they feel, would be endangered if Central America was taken over by opposition regimes. 56% of imported oil refineries are in the Caribbean islands. It's another reason. We have big oil interests in the Caribbean. So this domino theory extends to that our oil companies are scared that their islands will be the next dominoes to fall. Also, there are many oil reserves in Mexico, Venezuela, and Trinidad, and also obviously the military the military concern about the proximity to our border. So that's where the United States stands. We feel we have a great interest down there, and we're just denying any friendship at all to the Nicaraguans because we're so scared of their Marxist label. Whereas we're pushing them more and more to accept that Marxist label. And the people, you know, are being forced into that. Any more questions? I can go on. Lately, what has been happening is we have been concentrating on the Honduras as far as trying to export this, or as far as trying to help the Contras, the counter-revolutionaries along the border. And so we've upgraded the Honduras, I believe, to a level B, the Honduran embassy to a level B. And there's only one other level B, which is a rather high level of embassy. There's only one other level B in Latin America, and that's in Mexico. So what makes the Honduras so significant that way, I don't know. But we are definitely putting a lot of money and a lot of emphasis upon the Honduran embassy and the things that go on there. The Newsweek article of November 8, 1982 does a good job about talking about that and about our ambassador, John Negroponte, who's there. He used to be in the counterinsurgency, head of the counterinsurgency forces for a long time. And so that I guess he's in the right position there. What's happening...
He was
the head of the agent, what was it, in the CIA, part of the counterinsurgency, like developing counterinsurgency forces for nations and trying to export that. The United States is training a lot of ex-Somocistas and National Guardsmen in Miami and in California. They're training them so that they can send them back down and lead a counter-revolution. Many bridges have been bombed in Nicaragua, and while we were there, they made us stay pretty much in the western portion of Nicaragua. We had planned on going over to Bluefields, which is over in the east, But they said that it's just too dangerous, that they wouldn't allow us to go over there. So it even had an impact upon us. As far as the Mosquito Indians are concerned, I don't know how much you know about that, but Nicaragua is pretty much divided into two ethnic groups with two very different cultures. First of all, on the western border, there are the Spanish-speaking Nicaraguans, I guess, from way back. And here we have the Indian population that are English-speaking, because the English had controlled this for quite some time, the eastern border. So what happened, there's a real alienation there from the start. And Somoza really tried to cater to the Mosquito Indians, who were primarily in the northeastern sector of Nicaragua. And he tried to cater to them throughout his dynasty. And these people get flooded out about every third year. They live along the Rio Coco River. And they get flooded out so often that they always require relief packages. And so Somoza would send over relief packages, and they'd call it non-fat, because it was all non-fat milk. They could see it, so that was their word for it. And so he kind of endeared himself with the Mosquitoes, and a lot of them were against the revolution from the start. And the Sandinistas went over there, and they said, well, you know, you're not doing us much good. You keep speaking out against us. So what we'd like to do, and also this is a big area for counter-revolutionary attacks. They were coming down from this area, because a lot of the ex-National Guardsmen were up there with the Mosquito Indians. So they said, well, in order for a lot of the innocent Indians not to get caught up in the fighting, we'd like to move them down into central Nicaragua, because, you know, to get them out of there. And also we'll weed out those that are hostile to the Sandinista front, and then we'll be able to, you know, to know our boundaries up there a little bit better. So that's what they did, is they had a big migration of the Mosquito Indians. It wasn't very well run, and they'll be the first to admit that now. It was kind of by surprise. They sent a lot of their army folks up there and brought the Mosquitoes down into central Nicaragua. And no one was hurt or killed in the transport, but if you're going to transport one culture from one area to another, you can just think of the devastating ramifications of that. So the Nicaraguan government caught a lot of grief for that. And meanwhile, a lot of the Mosquito Indians fled into the Honduras, and now are teamed up with the ex-National Guardsmen and the Somocistas up there in counter-revolutionary forces. So they've caught a lot of grief for that. That's when, if you can remember, when Haig brought out the pictures of burning bodies in Nicaragua, and those turned out to be false pictures. I mean, you know, the caption wasn't correct that Haig had used. Rather, those were Red Cross people burning bodies that Somoza had killed during his regime. So once again, Haig had turned something completely around, and most Americans were oblivious to the retraction that came into the came in the newspapers a couple days later. So they feel they did blunder with that. There was a lot of tension there between the Sandinista army and the Mosquito Indians in that move, and there were a lot of there was a lot of bad press about that. But that's just one of the mistakes of a young government, I would guess. Another thing that's come about is because of the covert actions of the CIA and the counterinsurgents, there's been a declared state of emergency in Nicaragua. And the militia, which is a popular militia, pretty much everyone's armed. You see a lot of people carrying arms around on the streets, but you don't feel threatened, because you know, they feel that a popular revolution, you should put a gun in everyone's hand, and that shows the credibility of the revolution. And anyway, you see militia people on every bridge now, no matter how insignificant. There's a militia person there protecting that. And also there's a ban on the press, or a censorship on the press. La Prensa has to, at least when we were there, that was a year ago, so it might have changed now. It might even be more repressive, I don't know. But La Prensa had to take their copy to the Sandinistas to the junta and have them examine it before they could print it, because they had printed so many slanderous things that they said, hold, you know, this is getting out of control. This just isn't responsible journalism anymore, and it was undermining the movement. And you know, it's okay if it's true; they can accept constructive criticism, but when it's just out and out lies and pretty much things to feed Reagan, you know, if Reagan says, well, this is what the Nicaraguan newspapers are reporting, so it's got to be true, then, you know, that's got to stop. This is irresponsible journalism. So that's been something hard for Americans to accept. We say, well, that shows a sign of an ever-increasing repression in Nicaragua. But it's just kind of, it's reality. It has to come about. And the way I see it is Sandinistas don't have to keep La Prensa open. You know, if they were that concerned about it, they would never have allowed an opposition newspaper to form. So I guess it's some consolation to the opposition that they can even keep their newspaper open. As I mentioned before, that this is Chamorro's son who's the editor of this, and his uncle is the editor of Nuevo Diario. Well, the brother of the editor of La Prensa is the editor of Barricada. And they all have the last name Chamorro of all the three newspapers, so that gives each newspaper its own credibility. So, you know, everyone says, well, this is Chamorro's son or brother, you know, of the assassinated Chamorro. But the whole family's just split. And I can't even imagine what their family reunions are like. I guess that's pretty much the extent of what I wanted to talk about. I'd like to field some questions. As far as I was concerned, when I was down there, I had a good feeling that what had happened was that the revolution was successful, that you know, sure, it was going to be a long struggle, that I was kind of ashamed, very much ashamed, as an American citizen, that I had been sort of indirectly or perhaps directly involved in Somoza regimes. It saddened me especially because I know that oppression that had been going on in Nicaragua goes on just throughout the world today. And I think it's our responsibility to become aware of that and to speak out against it. And most of all, to help the opposition to that and help the people come out of that oppression. The people there were full of energy. They really welcomed us with open arms. They're very warm people. Everyone said, go back and tell your story to other Americans, because they feel that the American press skews things so badly that we don't get a correct picture painted. And I really feel that too, that take everything you read in papers and periodicals with a grain of salt. I guess I'd encourage you all to write to your congresspeople and senators and let them know that you support the present regime in Nicaragua, and that it's not just flying by your ears like everyone else's. But if you've got some questions.
You hear more, although it's our press, I understand, you hear more about people who were part of the revolution, or at least sympathetic to it, Roman Catholic missionaries who now have come up here very disillusioned with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you discount those two, or is it more repressive now than it was? Or
you see, to me, the present regime there has so many. I mean, there are a lot of things wrong with it. Yeah. Granted, but look at all the forces that are fighting against them. It doesn't even seem like they have a chance to establish themselves. But just comparing what I saw down there to the conditions before we were there, it's just like the difference between day and night, like life and between life and death for people. Because I have two instances. First of all, I was just walking in downtown Managua. I've never seen a capital city anywhere that looked like that. There's one skyscraper, and that's the Bank of America, and that survived the earthquake. But there, in downtown Managua, which is the capital city of this country, there are lots which are just rubble to this very day from the earthquake, never repaired, and I'm sure they wouldn't be for another decade or two. And it's just unbelievable, the sight. It's just, the whole town has just been devastated, and that's 10 years ago that happened. And the second example is we went to a coffee plantation, which was run by Somoza while he was in power. And the people he had there were pretty much slaves. And they lived, each family lived in a little cubicle, which is 4 feet by 5 feet by 9 feet. And it was in a big barn, and it was one of these cubicles right next to the next one, and layered up and, you know, all the way up, 4 layers high and probably 15 across in a big barn on either side. You just walk down one walkway in between them. There's no privacy, no lights, no sanitation. It's just outrageous that a whole family had to live in that little cubicle. And now that has been given, and through an over, all around the plantation were big fences. You can just imagine the mill, you know, that there are National Guards people, National Guardsmen, I guess it was in Nicaragua, that patrolled the fences. And now that has been given over to the people. And you see people getting their first home, even though it's a little, you know, it's probably no bigger than an outhouse to us, but it's their home. You know, it's their first home away from these cubicles. And they're running their own business, and they're growing the crops for themselves. And it's just, it's a great feeling to see that and knowing what the conditions were beforehand. Because, you know, just seeing the emotions in the people, you know, recalling what it had been like. But what scares me is after a revolution, those emotions can stay high for only so long. And then, you know, that's gotta peak sometime, people become disillusioned and say, well, you know, what are we fighting for? The revolution was the easy part, you know, now the hard part comes. And I think the people of Nicaragua have been realizing that the same thing will happen in El Salvador and Guatemala and all the rest. If those oppressive governments are overthrown, then that'll be the easy part, because the reconstruction and the reestablishment of a new government is the toughest thing going, especially with the United States sticking needles in your back all the time.
Paul, whatever happened to Somoza?
He flew to Paris, and he eventually came back to Uruguay, I think, and died of a heart attack. The first Somoza was assassinated, but I'm not sure how the second one died of natural causes. Another thing to keep in mind, just reading in Sojourners, I hadn't heard anything about this when I was down there, but Sojourners said that the Nicaraguan revolution started out as a nonviolent revolution. It started out with marches and strikes, and those were just, they were rendered inadequate. I mean, that's useless, that's futile to those people. At least that's the way they see it, that's, you know, they weren't making any progress. And so they went the route of armed struggle, armed uprising. And it was, I mean, the conflict itself was devastating to the country as well.
Yeah, I'm not very well informed about Nicaragua, but I just wanted to share the lens through which I look at it. First, there's a tendency in the 20th century for revolutionary regimes, once they win power, to overnight become the most reactionary and repressive regimes in the world in the name of defending the revolution. Mm-hmm. The one in Russia under Lenin and later under Stalin was, in my view, worse than the Tsarist regime. And Castro is debatable, but in some respects, respect to newspapers and freedom of expression, somewhat worse than Batista. So revolutionary regimes almost overnight become repressive in the name of the revolution. Sometimes it's almost inevitable. The second point is that I want to make is, again, not knowing much about Nicaragua, is that when you live next to a powerful neighbor, you have to make necessary compromises. And the country in Europe that I admire immensely is Finland. They are next to Russia, yet they have a democratic government, they have a free press, they have a combination of socialism and capitalism, they have no armed forces, they are neutral, they don't belong to NATO, and they don't belong to the Soviet bloc. So I admire Finland. They have some of the the most astute statesmen in Europe who have kept their independence next to Russia. A less good example is Austria. They too are neutral, not belonging to the Warsaw Pact nor to NATO. I had a feeble liking for Castro, and yet I am basically not a supporter of Castro's group, because they were so hostile to the United States and the enthusiasm for the revolution that I knew they would have very little choice except either to fail or else become very, very friendly with Russia. Nicaragua and El Salvador are again, I feel, for various reasons, I would like them to have statesmen something like those of Austria and Finland in the orbit of the United States, trying their reforms but not being so hostile to the United States as they are. We are.
Are they? Are they hostile?
That's where my facts are very shaky, yeah. And you can correct me.
See, I don't believe they're hostile. I think they're continually trying to give the United States a chance to
be friendly. That's where I just don't know enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, the United States putting $19 million into CIA activities trying to overthrow the government, just the cards are against them. They're going to have, it seems to me like they're going to have to become repressive. And it's not on their own account. It's because of our own government.
Jim, we will not support a revolution in the world. Our policy, our foreign policy in this world is to maintain stability. That's our foreign policy. We were born in a revolution, yet we will not support a revolution.
Unless it's
in a communist bloc country.
Yeah, I agree. America born in a revolution becomes immediately a conservative country. I'm stretching my point a little bit, but in a sense we became the same way, except luckily our democracy survived for various reasons. Partly because we had no enemies on our borders to let us develop and fight our own civil war without other people intervening and all that, as you know so well.
Jim, what do you think would happen, just hypothetically, if the United States supported the Sandinistas in Nicaragua and the revolution and gave them help and weaned them of the Soviet influence? I mean, heck, they're closer to us than the Soviets are to them. They're in our sphere.
I will say one small point, that when Castro won, I had this funny feeling. For the first time, the United States has a sort of a Soviet outpost on its border, 90 miles from Florida. All European countries have lived with enemies on their borders forever, France, Germany, Russia, and the rest. Maybe America can use Castro as a test of its maturity. Can we have the steadiness of many European governments with enemies on our borders? In essence, we flunked that test. We became almost insane on the subject. I would like for us to use this as a test personally. Can we be at least the wisdom of European statesmen to have groups of people who are fairly hostile to capitalism and to the United States fairly close to us, and have a steady patience with them, as many Europeans have had to survive with a steady patience? We are flunking the test once more, Jim.
Well, I don't know.
Well, one thing about Nicaragua is they're trying to go a third way. You know, when you say Marxist, too many people say, "Oh, that's the Soviet Union," or "That's China." That's nowhere. Marx is rolling over in his grave right now, I'm sure. But they're trying to go a third way. They're trying to have a mixed economy. They don't want to have a completely communist or socialist economy. They feel that there is room for that third way if they can get the cooperation of their natural trading partners and not be undermined the way they are. Their new ideology, which the Pope condemned when he was in Nicaragua recently, has four parts, according to Miguel de Escoto. One is nationalism, and that is they don't want to export the revolution. They feel that it came from the grassroots of Nicaragua, and that's where it should come in all countries. Second, that it has democratic aspirations. They want real participation of the people. That's why they put such an emphasis upon their literacy campaign. They said only people who are educated can make intelligent decisions. And a lot of people, what they do, I put down Pedagogy of the Oppressed here by Paulo Freire. And that's the way by which they went about educating these people. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with it, but it's a lot of people call it indoctrination. But what it is consciousness raising. And when you talk, you know, you talk about your role as a citizen or your role as a member of the world community, and especially to those in countries where they're being oppressed, you talk about your role as a person oppressed and make people aware of how they are participating in that, and perhaps there's something wrong there. And so, you know, that's very important to these people. Third aspect of that is the Christian element. And they say, relentless in the struggle, but generous in the victory. And I had a real feeling for that they're not trying to torture and kill all the guardsmen, who they probably have a right to do, I guess. But instead, they're trying to rehabilitate them and putting them in humane prisons. So, and they abolished the death penalty. So I think they're making a lot of inroads that way. And most of all, they're seeking a system of social justice. They don't want the oppression to be perceived like the oppression or the repression against the media. You know, that's a factor of national security. We've had that in our country as well. A lot of people get down in Nicaragua, they say, well, they haven't had elections there. So, you know, how could it be a popular government? But first of all, the Sandinistas do have overwhelming popular support. And they have established elections for 1985. So, you know, I hope they make that milestone.
There isn't any one dominating person in the revolution, is there?
They're trying to keep it... trying to keep away from personalities, because that's been the demise of every revolution, you know, ever since whenever. That if you have one personality, then it is going to become, it has more possibility of becoming more totalitarian, and people don't feel they have the participation, feel that they're subjugated to this, to one person.
Well, can you talk more about the Pope's visit? Like, what do you
think? Yeah. The Pope was there, and his main gripe is, as has been along for quite a while, is that he doesn't like to see the priests in the government positions. And he's, ever since the revolution took place and the priests put themselves in these positions, or they were putting these positions, the Pope has spoken out against that. He said that either you have to be a priest or a government official, one of the two. And so the priest said, well, there were five of them who were actively in the government. And they said, okay, we'll make a compromise. We won't conduct mass while we're in these government positions. But the Pope wasn't happy with that at all. And another thing that gets in his craw is that Archbishop Obando y Bravo is very much against the Sandinistas now, because he sees a popular church rising in Nicaragua that disregards his hierarchical position. And he feels intimidated that way. And the whole power structure of the Catholic Church is being undermined that way. And it's a power structure that was probably very influential in the Somoza dictatorship for a number of years. Although in the later years, Archbishop Obando y Bravo was against the Somozas. He wanted them to be overthrown, but they're very much scared by the Marxists as being anti-religious, I guess.
Wasn't it part of a compromise that the priests made, too, that they would be in the government only on an interim basis?
Right, right. That's the reason they were there. They felt that they, you know, that their abilities were needed in the government, in the young government at that time. And what they felt it was going to be for an interim period. And I myself, I struggle with that, you know, I think they should get out as soon as possible so they don't alienate any more people that way. But they have done some good things in their positions. And I don't know, that's a tough one for me. I don't know.
It would seem to me that to have a successful Nicaraguan government where it's Marxist and democratic and allows for religion would be a tremendous threat to the ruling powers of America. I think, you know, because it's like the America seems to say, how evil communist is, and it's anti-democratic and it's anti-religious.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a Marxist government that allows freedom and allows religion would be very intolerable. It's much easier to hate a Russia than a Chile.
Right. Right.
And
yeah.
So it would see why Nicaragua would be a very real threat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very, very threat.
Another thing with the Pope is I think he struggles himself a lot with the Marxism. That, you know, if he supports a Marxist regime, then that could really have a big impact on perhaps splitting the Catholic Church to a certain degree.
He's also Poland.
What's that?
He's also concerned about Poland. And there's a Marxist regime in Poland.
Sure.
So even though can he support a Marxist regime in Nicaragua and not in Poland?
Yeah. His words that he was very concerned with the ideological commitments that Nicaragua had made, and so he felt like their top priority was Marxism rather than Christianity.
Although I think when the Pope was there, they weren't particularly nice to him.
No, they weren't. And yeah, I find that upsetting. I think that they should at least give him their token respect, I guess. Jim?
The Polish thing interests me a whole lot, because you notice I didn't use Poland in my example of Austria and Finland. For years in this argument that I had used before, I had always used Poland. And the Polish had, among the World War II politicians of great skill, the Catholic leadership in Poland has been among the most skillful in the world. And when the Polish workers started their thing, there are sort of an American-type union with many other type of ramifications, because communist unions are absolutely fraudulent. I am a strong union man, and all over Russia and Eastern Europe, the unions there are just absolute frauds. And this union that developed there was very appealing, and the Catholic authorities, with excellent skill, tried to tell them to slow down, but the excitement of it all was such that they could not put brakes on it. So my view is not the Polish Pope and the Cardinal in Poland are very skilled people whom I do not criticize, because they knew that there would be a military takeover there if these demands kept on and on and on. That's true of the Union leader there too. He is not to be criticized. One other perspective, Paul, I want to say, looking from without much information on this, I was a little bit, just a molecule displeased when you said there are great numbers of arms are necessary. Here is the lens through which I look at that. The World War I was the most disillusioning experience in all of European history in many respects, and young people all over the world said, no more war forever. Then came the Spanish Civil War. They had a wicked name under Franco, fascist. So every good virtue of socialism and democracy and humanity and reform was at stake there. 3,000 or 4,000 young Americans went, called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. The Spanish Civil War is too long for me to go into, but in my view, it was a mistake for people to fight in that war. Those young Americans who went there, in my view, made a mistake. And in this holding here, where we have a tendency towards pacifism and so forth, we're in a sense like young people in the 1930s. When the right cause comes along, in a sense like Paul, like myself in that age, with a certain amount of romanticism against fascism, we say, to arms, to arms. We should keep some of Holden's caution with us even when we go beyond this place.
Jim, what point are you trying to make?
Don't jump in for a Spanish Civil War type situation. You, and you.
In other words, we shouldn't
probably be a huge mistake to take up arms with the Sandinistas, just as a hasty example.
Yeah, that's not our position. I mean, that's a popular revolution that was started in the grassroots of that country.
Yeah.
And that's,
it's already established, Jim. They're there.
Yes, but suppose that the pressures from financed by the United States and others, as you know, Franco was financed by Mussolini and by Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And so to fight him was fighting Hitler and Mussolini in the early stages from 1935 on. So if the United States CIA is sponsoring forces from Honduras, that would be in my own romantic nature for democracy and all this to side with them. To go there would be a mistake.
Well, tell Reagan so that when he continues this domino theory stuff, I don't have to go down to Central America and fight against the Sandinistas or the leftists in El Salvador. You know,
okay, my case is too hypothetical, so let's just drop it.
Nick, my fear, and I gather that it's a fear of yours too. My impression of the revolution is a positive one, mainly because of my daughter Karen and the kinds of things, not where you and she and students and Joel Muggy got convinced, but by a very conservative pediatrician from North Dakota who went down there and came home and is just livid. He writes to Reagan and says, "Sir, I supported you throughout your campaigns. I voted for you as president. I am a conservative Republican. You are absolutely wrong in Nicaragua." I mean, when he was able to walk and came back, turned around, middle-aged conservative physician from North Dakota, I don't need a lot more input. My fear is similar to a very brief visit in Ethiopia, where a repressive Haile Selassie, where the peasants were oppressed, where the missionaries we were with were in favor of the revolution, where they started with land reform and good people, all of whom are now gone. The government in Ethiopia does not have anybody similar to Ernesto Cardenal or any of the rest. And in that vacuum, there is a regime which is very repressive, probably more repressive than Haile Selassie had been, and the peasants are worse off than ever. My fear is that the ones who are going to suffer in some kind of vacuum, either Contra is coming back down, or somebody moving in when this doesn't work. And that's, it seems to me, what our present foreign policy of the United States is making that almost inevitable.
Sure.
That this will collapse. It really is frustrating. And so when you write, or when you speak, I mean, for you to speak about the issues there is helpful, and I wish more people did. What are you saying? That we ought to
be aware
simply
of
withdraw? That obviously aid to CIA and other things and not blow up their bridges, but do we admit that we're, I guess we do admit that we have ships sending balloons over and other things, don't we? So you can certainly have an outcry about that. Do you think if we traded with them that they would make it, or at least if we took away our continuing to nibble away and train countries that they would make it? Have they repaid some of their debts? Do they have a financial stability?
Well, first of all, third world nations, when they undergo a revolution, their economies are set in the economic system that has been established there over the decades before that.
Yeah.
And so they're stuck there with coffee and cotton and a lot of those items. They have to continue to produce those, because you can't just have change your whole agricultural system around to more self-sufficiency and things like that. And they're locked into those loans. That's a tough question, but I'd like to see them have a chance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
A year ago.
without having, like Cuba, without having to have the crutch of the Soviet Union come in.
One brief question. Why do you think, with literacy up, and the La Prensa, a opposition newspaper, why is that still the one read the most? I mean, do you have
a
guess?
My guess is the people who buy the paper are primarily those who, first of all, can afford it.
I see.
And those who are used to buying the paper.
Yeah.
You know, the bourgeoisie.
They let you visit with La Prensa.
Right, yeah, that was interesting. first of all, I'd like to premise this with saying that, like you're talking about your visit to Ethiopia, that I went down there feeling that I was going to be indoctrinated, and I was very excited about what I was going to see, and I was excited about what I saw, and I had to take everything I saw with a grain of salt, because I've been in the Soviet Union too, and that, you know, that's something you can't believe everything you hear or take as a model everything you see. And I went into it with that feeling, but overriding that was the energy of the people and the drastic changes that I had seen that came about since Somoza. As far as Lorenzo was concerned, I went in there with a lot of that indoctrination, and you know everything he said. I was told that this everything he said was a pack of lies, and I think for the most part it probably was. But I just went in there suspicious and kind of disregarded everything he said, I guess, because it was easy to do. He was kind of a crony, and I don't know. I just got a bad feeling being around him. Whereas the other newspapers were very cordial to us, and very, of course, they said what we wanted to hear too. So, but no, that is a danger when you go to a country like that, and I'm not saying that this is totally objective what I'm saying here, but that's just my experience. And once again, it's not a perfect revolution, but it's a heck of a lot better than it was 5 years ago, the conditions in that country for the basic people. And I don't know, I'd like to see what would happen if the United States would leave them alone. I would, seeing the energy of those people after the revolution, I think that they could do it. But for how long, I don't know.
It's kind of nice that they still see U.S. people as people and are friendly. They do not blame ordinary people for any of their problems.
Oh,
that's what everybody says.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
The Ethiopian, a word of hope, the Ethiopian peasants, the world's peasants are so resilient. I mean, that's a kind of patronizing statement for me to make. But what they said in essence was, we used to suffer a lot under Haile Selassie and U.S. and imperialism. We suffer now. The difference is the other oppressors, the U.S. and the Haile Selassie, had better humor. They say that the Russians and Cubans are so grim that the former oppressors smiled more. And they said, I mean, I just couldn't believe that they could do that kind of nonchalant about their oppression. They were really such fine people, just amazing people. And the energy there, that was the church with the most energy, was the persecuted church, the Lutheran church in Ethiopia. I was just inspired to be with them. I was with a man who was probably going to jail the next day for an illegal meeting. And, you know, we had this evening of prayer and fun, and he honked three times when he went by our place the next morning and drove off. I just couldn't believe I was with somebody that was facing that, there was no sense of feeling sorry or pity. It was just a thrill to be with him. It's amazing.
Another thing about Nicaragua is, as far as the women's issue down there, they were very active in the revolution, but now I don't feel they're getting a fair share, a fair shake. And there are a lot of women in lower governmental positions, but none in the higher. And higher. And that's my train of thought. But that's a real concern for me. You know, I think that would be a real proof that the revolution, that people did have their consciousness raised. Because they did, they did realize the equality there, not only of between men, but also between men and women. And go again. Oh, but one thing that's really tough to get over in Latin America is the machismo attitude, and that is, you know, men are dominant, and that is, I mean, that's hard to transcend. There's just not even a revolution is going to do that. So I don't know what the answers are there for women. But I've got a good book if you want to read about a woman in the revolution. It's by Doris Tijerino, Inside the Nicaraguan Revolution. And it was written like in 1975. So it talks a lot about the grassroots efforts and the role of women within that. Also, I've got a book on Archbishop Romero from El Salvador, if anybody wants to read that. So, any more questions? Otherwise, I'd like to read one thing talking about especially the theology that was underlying the revolution. The biblical theology of empire has inspired great hope among the Christians of Central America. They see the story of the Hebrews and the early church as their own story, and they claim the promise of liberation. The story should give us hope as well, for it is clear every day that the future of the world depends in large part on the United States learning to live peacefully with its neighbors. There is no better place for that to begin than with our closest neighbors to the South. Our biblical faith and historical situation in the United States call us to unmask the false and idolatrous claims of the empire, to refuse to fight its wars, and to place our allegiance not with the policies of our nation, but with Jesus, who is among its victims. In everyday political terms, that will mean recognizing, as a beginning, that the nations of Central America and the Caribbean are not our backyard. They are other people's homes, where they are sovereign. Eventually, our call will mean seeking to turn this nation away from an economic order and culture that requires the subjugation of other peoples and towards a recognition of our limits and our interdependence. We seem further from that possibility now than we have ever been, but we can undertake to journey toward it because we too have been given the promise of liberation.